And as that really stirring piece of music fades away, all you're left with is me. Sorry about that, but don't worry, we'll play the track again in between the sections, so the next 20 minutes or so won't be all that bad. I have to say many thanks to all of you who took the time to comment so favourably on the first podcast, whether on public forums or by email. It's really nice to know that our efforts in putting all of this together were so well appreciated, and it's a real incentive for us to get this edition going. So what can you expect this time round? To be honest, pretty much what you got last time. There's the section where you get my opinions on a subject, and this time it's about wargamers and reenactors. The work in progress slot will let you know what's happening with the summer projects and developments in the Polymos Rules series. Then you'll be getting my impressions of the last couple of shows I attended, and a preview of where we'll be going in the next few months. The review section sees me looking at some pre-cut bases from Tiny Tin Soldiers, and a guest review from Florida's George Pearson. I'll be answering your questions and giving feedback on some of the comments and topics that have arisen over the last few weeks. As ever, I'd like to invite anyone listening to contribute themselves. If you want to bring my attention to a topic that needs discussing, review a product from either Bacchus or a third party, pass comment on something that I've said or written, please do get in touch. I can even accept audio submissions, so if you feel like recording a response, please feel free to join in. In response to a number of requests, I've decided to give Igor a break from his 19-hour day on the casting machine in order to share some of his wit and wisdom with you. Here for your delectation and education is this week's A Word from Igor.
Ventov.
That was this week's word from Igor. Before we finally get onto the interesting bits, I will answer the single most repeated question that came from the first podcast. The music that we use throughout is called Flight in Time. I've no idea of the composer, but it can be downloaded for a small fee from stockmusic.net, a site specialising in the supply of copyright-free music for use in online media. Speaking of which, let's close this section with some Flight in Time. Around this time of year, wargaming in the UK tends to be dominated by just one topic, Salute. Manufacturers release new lines there, clubs pull out all the stops to put on the best games, painters apply brush to metal to try and win the painting competitions. While some people will travel halfway around the world just to be there, others publicly declare that they wouldn't be seen dead crossing the threshold. Always controversial, it is quite simply in a league of its own when it comes to wargame shows. With this preeminent position, it always seems to attract more than its fair share of criticism. This year was no exception. I'll be giving my personal review of Salute 2007 in a later section, but for those of you who haven't heard, the main subject of debate was the presence of a reenactment group. Now this is nothing new for Salute, or indeed many other wargame shows. The problem was that these reenactors were recreating an SS unit. What compounded this controversial issue was that the females in the group were dressed in Nazi uniforms and their children were walking around dressed as Hitler Youth. Their static displays included both military hardware and the German home front, including a child's bedroom complete with Hitler posters. Whilst opinion seems divided, I have to admit that I was seriously uncomfortable with all of this. Whilst I'm a reenactor myself, and my own period of interest in the English Civil War was not short of atrocities, I found the whole experience unsettling, especially the sight of the recreated Hitler Youth. As for what members of the public and those visitors to the show from Germany and from countries that suffered the excesses of the Nazi regime thought of it, can only be imagined. It is still far too raw a subject for anyone to view it with any degree of objectivity. I think South London Warlords invited the group with the best of intentions, but scored a massive own goal. To me, this is a great shame, as the argument over this issue has overshadowed what in all other ways was a magnificent event. Anyway, that's my last word on the subject. However, the debate that all this caused did raise another more interesting topic, that of the relationship between wargamers and reenactors. Now I, like some others, can quite happily regard myself as being in both camps. I've pushed my little toy soldiers around tables, and I've worn armour and fired a musket. I have many friends and customers who are likewise comfortable with both pastimes. However, we do seem to be a very small subgroup. One interesting side effect of the debate has been to bring to the fore lots of wargamers who seem to either despise reenactors or who quite happily belittle them. Many opinions have been expressed along the lines of they shouldn't really be at any wargame show. Quite a lot of very deeply held prejudices there. But wait on a moment. How do reenactors regard wargamers? Now that's an interesting question. It's perhaps always good to see ourselves as others see us. And as it happens, I do have an insight into that particular question. A friend of mine runs the Original Reenactors Market here in the UK. This takes place twice a year, and I took the backer's stand along to the market a few times. Now, lest anyone be in doubt as to the strength of reenacting, both market events attract numbers that overtake those attending salutes. The market itself takes place over 3 days, and like salute, it attracts traders and attendees from all over the world. The money taken by some of the stands there would make any trader at salute start glowing green with envy. Make no mistake about it, this is not a small show, nor a small hobby. So how did backers in particular, and the hobby of wargaming in general, go down with reenactors? It was fine with that little subgroup to which I belong of reenacting wargamers. With the rest, and these were the vast majority, there was complete apathy, an embarrassed backing away from the stand, laughter, mickey-taking about playing with toy soldiers, and a question as to what I was doing with a stall when the place could have been better served by giving it to a reenactment trader. In short, the very mirror image of the sort of reaction that reenactors get at wargame shows. Now, as you may have gathered, I find both sets of reactions quite strange. Both groups are interested in the past and in military history. Both groups have some degree of interest in research and getting things right. Both groups are in many ways a fringe hobby, which most of society at large finds geekish and the source of much humour. Yet we have far more in common with each other than the things that divide us. But there seems to be mutual intolerance. However, to my mind, both groups are just two sides of the same coin. Yes, you can bump into a fat, overweight buffoon of a reenactor who knows little about his chosen period, but likes to drink a lot. But are there no wargamers out there who are overweight, ill-informed apart from an army list, will field unpainted figures, and also likes to pour beer down his neck? I can point you in the direction of a large number of serious, very knowledgeable, well-equipped, reasonably svelte, and not very geeky reenactors. And you may not think it, but these chaps are having a massive and positive influence on our hobby. Yes, reenactors are good for wargaming. Let me give you an example. When I started reenacting the English Civil War back in the early 1980s, the best information on the period for wargamers came from three main sources. The books of Brigadier Peter Young, a section in George Gush's Renaissance Armies, and there were two Ospreys. Wargamers seemed very happy with these. It soon became apparent that reenactors were not. When you have to know how armour is worn, how a coat should be cut and put together, who carried what colour, what formations and drill were really used, the usual wargamer's range of secondary sources is simply not enough. Reenactors like Stuart Peachey, Les Prince, Stuart Reed and Alan Turton began reading sources afresh and investigating new ones. What passed as facts were re-examined and old myths discarded. Interest was taken in how battles were fought and conducted. As a result, a huge body of fresh information emerged. Although this was primarily aimed at improving reenactors' performance and dress, it began to filter through to wargamers. Since this time, Ospreys, campaign books, flag sheets, Lots of rule sets and entire figure ranges have been built on the research produced by these reenactors, none of whom have ever touched a toy soldier. Wargamers took to the new information like a pack of starving foxes suddenly finding the door open to a turkey shed, without once thinking of who had let them in. If an English Civil War wargamer of today with a collection of Bacchus or Foundry, Perry or Matchlock figures, painted using the guides found on the Bacchus site or in the Forlorn Hope rules, adorned with paper flags and using any of half a dozen new ECW rule sets, then declares English Civil War reenactors to be a waste of space, he is showing complete ignorance and ingratitude towards those people who have actually made a large part of his chosen wargames period accessible to him. And I know that the same can be said across a number of different periods. The marvellous Gripping Beast Dark Ages range shows all the signs of reenactment input. The same can be said of any figures produced by the Perrys. I suspect you'll find similar stories in all of the major periods. Reenactors boast a large number of serious and dedicated researchers and historians doing work which feeds through to wargamers. Now think about that the next time you condemn all of them just because one guy's looking a little too rotund to fit into his uniform coat. Remember the line about people who live in glass houses. That's it for this section. Please do send me your reactions and comments to backers6@aol.com. This section is about UK wargame shows, or more accurately, those wargame shows that are graced by the presence of the Bacchus stand. I know that to a lot of overseas listeners, this all just seems to rub it in as to how lucky we are in the UK, but at the same time, none of you have told me to stop talking about it. So to start with, here's a look back at the shows we've done. And we'll start with triples. Now let's get this out of the way first. I like triples. I like it because it is a big, friendly two-day show. I like it because I can sell lots of things but still have time to talk to people. But let's be brutally honest here. The reason that I really like triples is that its full title is Sheffield Triples. That's right, no getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to travel there for this one. We're able to take our time setting the stand-up on early Friday evening and enjoy a serious line on Saturday morning. Bliss! Anyway, this show marked the first public outing of the Zulus from the Colonial Range, a fact that we were able to celebrate by selling out of them completely before the doors opened on Saturday. All in all, an excellent show with only one black spot. Since the last show, the venue has changed catering suppliers. Chris and I went for our traditional cooked breakfast, but were shocked to be greeted by a healthy eating menu. I'm sorry, but smoothies and vegetable wraps are no replacement for bacon, sauce, eggs, beans and fried bread where I come from. No matter how tempting the range of organic dressings on offer. Now, judging by the number of hungry wargamers milling about the place, we weren't the only ones to think this. A month later came Salute. The mighty Salute. The biggest show in the UK. South London Warlords had made arrangements for traders to set up on Friday afternoon. This is a great help. The Excel Centre is so big that there is no problem at all with traders driving their vehicles into the hall and unloading next to their stand. The only thing that marred this arrangement for me was a Jobsworth coming up to me and telling me to move my car, despite the hall being largely empty and with half a dozen other vehicles that I could see that had actually been there before I arrived. Now, the Saturday was everything I expected it to be. Having the stall set up on Friday was a great help, but time flew and the doors were open before we knew it. We were releasing the new Science Fiction Centaur range, including the huge Walking City module, and the British Colonials. Both were brisk sellers all day long. However, the Old Faithfuls were well in demand, and Bill and myself found that the hours sped by as we attempted to serve all the customers as quickly as we could. We weren't helped by the credit card reader having a minor brainstorm for a couple of hours in the middle of the day and refusing to log on to the network. I really wanted to chat with so many people at this show, but found myself just too busy to do so. I'm afraid I also didn't get much chance to see what was happening at the show apart from the area immediately around my stand. The game near to me that caught my eye was a very impressive Aztec-y sort of thing with big temple models and some nice toys to go with it. I'll tell you how impressed I was. I looked at it and I didn't think, now that would have looked so much better in 6mm. Now from me, that's high praise indeed. We finally left the venue at about 6:45, and by 8 o'clock were safely tucked up on a comfy seat with ample supplies of alcoholic beverages. Phew. So what's coming up? Next on the list comes Partizan, which is held at Kelham Hall in Newark on May 29th. Historically, this show has earned the reputation of being all about 28 mil figures, but the organisers have worked hard to change that by getting in games in different scales and letting impudent upstarts like me into the event. It's a well organised and run show with some superb games. The main problem, so far as I'm concerned, is that it is a backbreaker of a problem loading and unloading at the venue. My stand is about as far away as you can get from the door, so it's a long process to get all the stock and the fixtures backwards and forwards. Partizan is also one of those shows where the attendees get a free figure. Now my tip for you is to get to this particular Partizan. Believe me, it will be well worth it. The following weekend comes a new experience for us. We'll be attending the Phalanx show at St. Helens. Now a trip into the dark continent that is Lancashire is never a thing to be undertaken lightly by a true son of the White Rose, but the organisers have been so encouraging and so friendly that I really had to go. I can remember back to when the premier wargaming event in the country was a show called More Than Militaire, which was held in Manchester. Now that died sometime in the 1980s, and there doesn't seem to have been anything in the Northwest to replace it. I am looking forward to seeing what Phalanx is doing to rectify this. Finally, and very importantly, I'll be holding another Bacchus Open Day sometime in July. The date is yet to be confirmed, but there will be two sessions, one in the morning and one in the afternoon, with both parties meeting up for lunch at the nearby Gardener's Arms pub. You'll get a tour around the state-of-the-art Bacchus manufacturing facility, a chance to meet Igor, and you'll see how the process of making little soldiers is really done. No, it's not done by squirrels or by Oompa Loompas, and you get to ask as many questions about Bacchus as your fevered imaginations can conjure up. And inevitably, there is a shop. Places are restricted due to the size of the venue, so if you want to come, please book early. I'm happy to take bookings on behalf of a small party. All the details will be on the Bacchus site. I hope to see lots of you at any of these events. Remember that if you are going and you want to place a pre-order, please let me know as far in advance as possible. This is really recommended if you have a lengthy wants list. Any reactions and comments to me at bacchus6@aol.com. Now we'll have a look at the new items I'm working on and what's going to become available for you in the future. This is an almost inexhaustible topic of conversation at shows, so I know you'll find this of some interest. With the first half of the Zulu Wars range now out, work continues on completing the British and Imperial forces. This will include the native contingents and irregular light horse, along with carts and tentage. We'll finish off the British with officers and personalities, and the Zulus with some Induna and some cattle. After that, I promise, will come the Franco-Prussian War generals. Then we move on to the Duchy of Warsaw troops with Napoleonics, but I'm probably getting ahead of myself here. I'm personally working on two projects. Firstly, the 4th century Romans. This is coming along nicely, and I hope to wrap up the infantry very shortly before moving on to what will be an interesting range of cavalry. I'll get pictures of greens for these and the new colonials as they become available. My second project is getting some Centaur infantry ready for the Command Horizon range. I've got the basic dolly figure complete, so now it's a matter of equipping and arming them ready for tabletop use. There are still a number of new models to come in the Centaur vehicle range, with personnel transports and a skim fighter likely to appear in the next few weeks. We'll also be prepping the next city module ready for casting. This will be the habitation module. In terms of war games rules, playtesting and feedback has started on Polymus American Civil War. This project has created quite a stir, and the initial results are very promising. The aim is to produce a two-tier set, as was done with the Napoleonic version. One set will be for divisional level games, and the other for core level, both sets in the same rulebook. Currently, we have Polymus variants in differing stages of development, covering the American Civil War, Franco-Prussian War, Wars of the Roses, Seven Years' War, Ancients, Fantasy, and shortly to arrive, Colonial. If you're interested in helping the playtest process with any of these, please do get in touch. Also moving well are the Command Horizon rules. Version 3.0 has been available for a while now, but I hope to be able to release 3.1 by the end of May, which will include rules for the Centaurs, as well as giving some background information on this fascinating race, and adding a few more human vehicles. Please do send your reactions and comments to me at backers6@aol.com. Once again, we dive into the section that examines the strange concept that there may be more things out there for you to spend your money on than can be found in the pages of the Backers catalogue. A varied batch for you this time, and I'd like to start with a film. Yes, a film. Chris and I went to see 300. We were going to see it anyway, but the only topic of conversation that came over the counter to us at Triples seemed to start with, "Have you seen 300 yet?" Now, given that I'd also been sending out custom packs of 300 hoplites to large numbers of people, none of whom have yet to place the corresponding order for 1 million Persians, there was no real option but for us to pay the money, equip ourselves with the overpriced rubbish that passes for food in cinemas, and wait for the title sequences to roll. First point, this is not, repeat, not a historically accurate film. It makes no pretensions to be. It is a film of a graphic novel. I went to it expecting to be entertained and with no thoughts at all of the history. And I was not disappointed. I enjoyed the action bits. It was visually stunning. The washed-out flat tones and dramatic framing of a graphic novel all came across without detracting from the action. Yes, if you look closely, you could see that the 300 Spartans actually only numbered about 30. But given that with all the pecs, abs and baby oil exhibited by the Spartan warriors, there were only so many Chippendale lookalikes available for hire that could act or fight, this was quite understandable. This film was not done on the same scale or with the same budget as Lord of the Rings, but it didn't matter. The battle sequences were bloody, violent and extreme as you wanted. Spartans seemed to be able to kill Persians at will, and the said Persians seemed to relish their role by entering auto-destruct mode when coming within 3 feet of one of the main Spartan protagonists. The Persians were typically numberless and used cheats tricks like giant elephants and battle rhinos, both of which ended up being cut down to size by the manly Greeks. The special effects where the Persians darkened the sky with their arrows was very, very impressive. Xerxes himself seemed to combine the worst aspects of his Stargate Goa'uld with a bondage lover with very rich tastes. Enough gold chain to make Mr. T blink with disbelief. The acting and the characters were all very two-dimensional. But what could you expect? Leonidas shows enough teeth and does enough shouting to remind you of a very young Brian Blessed. And the actor himself is Scottish, which really unshowed up in his conversation with Xerxes. Close your eyes and it could have been Sean Connery speaking. The ending? Yes, predictable. Spoiler coming up. The Greeks all get killed. Sorry, if you haven't seen it yet, that's the end. So all in all, an enjoyable film. Some stunning visuals, some so-so acting, some over-the-top imagery, and lots of blood and gore. It's history as it should have been, but none the worse for that, as it has no pretensions to be otherwise. If you can still see it on the big screen, do so. I think a small screen will kill a lot of the spectacular action. And now, as the saying goes, for something completely different. George Pearson of Florida has sent me his thoughts on the board game Soldier Kings.
They say miniatures gamers love battles, but crave campaigns. Yet all too often, campaigns get bogged down in endless paperwork, tedious details, and rules disputes more vicious than any actual battle. Well, the solution to this dilemma is a good, relatively simple board war game that allows miniatures battles to take place within a broader context than just pick 'em up and play 'em at the local club. Might and Reason, the excellent 18th century rule set reviewed in Peter's last podcast, has a wonderful grand campaign option using the board war game Soldier Kings. Designed by the prolific Rob Markham and released by Avalanche Games, Soldier Kings is an ideal venue for miniatures campaign. The clean and simple system prevents play from bogging down, keeping the focus where it belongs, on creating situations for interesting and exciting miniatures battles. Boasting clear and colorful graphics true to the Enlightened period it depicts, Soldier Kings practically begs to be played, The maps reflect the ambitious scope of a game that is unique among Seven Years' War simulations. That conflict was the first true world war, and players will find themselves locked in battle from Java to Madras to Louisiana. Utilizing a point-to-point movement system, the game cleverly encourages players to struggle over such historical crossroads as Bohemia, Gibraltar, and the Caribbean. The various provinces are rated for defense, manpower, and most critically, wealth. As Cicero said, endless money forms the sinews of war. So it is with Soldier Kings. The game keeps players on a tight economic leash. Fighting a war of annihilation is exceedingly difficult, as it should be in any depiction of 18th century conflict. Battles are frightfully expensive, and fighting a series of them can lead to bankruptcy and an early exit from the game. This works well from a miniature standpoint, as big battles are rare and memorable. With Sam's rules, the battles that do occur allow an easy transition from board game to tabletop and back again. Card play supplements an excellent system by providing a wholesome degree of uncertainty, as well as a wealth of interesting chrome. Oh, so Pitt just became PM and boosted your number of provincial troops, did he? Pity they all have dysentery now. With 7 yearly scenarios and 1 grand campaign, accommodating anywhere from 1 to 8 players, and armies from 26 countries, no doubt enough figures to have Peter clapping his hands with glee, Soldier Kings will have players cheerfully playing and painting for quite some time.
Many thanks to George for this review, and he in turn would like to thank his son, also George, who acted as technician and sound recordist for his review. Moving on, we've got some items from Tony Hughes, who has recently started trading as Tiny Tin Troops. Although primarily a figure painter specialising in sub-15mm scales, Tony has a couple of other products on the market, and I'm going to look at his range of magnetic bases. Physically, they are pre-cut MDF bases, which come with a thin layer of magnetic material stuck to the bottom. This keeps bases nice and stable if your carrying cases or boxes are made of steel or lined with steel paper. Now, as I am about to move to this method of transport myself, I can appreciate its value. In terms of quality, they look very good. I have a whole range of sizes in front of me. All the edges are clean, all the angles look sharp, and to the naked eye are accurate. The layer of magnetic material is stuck on well, and when tested to destruction, it took a lot of effort to peel off. The product is therefore of good quality and robust. In terms of price, these are obviously more expensive than plain MDF bases of comparable dimensions, but this is only to be expected. Having said that, however, I don't think you find that they are out of the way. For example, a set of 46mm by 30mm bases will cost you £9. That's 23 pence each. The bases themselves come in a large range of sizes suitable for many different rule sets, and I'm sure they will be very popular. You can find more details of the bases and Tony's painting service at www.tinytintroops.co.uk. That's it for reviews this time. If you want to contribute yourself or have any reactions or comments on what you've heard today, please contact me at backers6@aol.com. And now it's time for some questions and answers. In actual fact, there's not that many questions have come in from you lot out there. Am I really that good at explaining things, or are you all just too shy? Please send me something to go on with next time. Anyway, here's a couple of questions that I have had. Firstly, Bob Arnetson asks, a while back you made a comment that Warmaster Ancients had displaced DBA as the main rules for which people buy Backers Ancients. Can you expand on that? Can I expand on anything? What a silly question. Okay. It's all been a matter of watching how sales patterns have changed. Most of my bulk sales in any period are made in terms of army packs. People like to get a starter army and then expand on it as they see fit. Right from the start, I've packaged armies for use with DBA and DBM rules. As an element-based system, they were ideal for 6mm. And to be honest, I only think that it's a quirk of history, hangover from the old 7th edition rules, that sees that system dominated by 15 rather than 6mm today. Anyway, when Warmaster Ancients came, I knew that they were going to be very popular. Not only was the basic War Master system very sound, it was also very popular. Like Warhammer Ancient Battles before it, it was also certain to bring a lot of fantasy players over to historical gaming, as it provided an easy transition. As a result, I had army packs ready and waiting for the release. Almost straight away, I noticed two things happening. Sales of the DBA-DBM packs in both 15mm and 25mm ground scales began to decline, while the Warmaster equivalents flew out. At first, I took both types of packs along with me to wargame shows, but pretty quickly dropped the DBA-DBM packs, as they just weren't selling. They do continue to sell, but the Warmaster Ancient versions outstripped them by 20-1. Also, a lot of people make use of the Warmaster Ancient Unit Builder option. It seems to be a far more vibrant and active rule system. Now, why is this? Well, the two rules are very different. While not perfect, Warmaster Ancients are clear, well laid out, and easy to pick up. DBA and DBM suffer by comparison, and despite claim to the contrary, are not easy to read or understand. And the pace of the games are very different. DBM is relatively slow compared to Warmaster Ancients. DBA is nice and quick, but it's abstract. 12 elements aside is not everyone's taste. One of the other major points to consider is that despite the fact that only 10mm figures appear in the Warmaster Ancient rulebook, there is no institutional resistance to 6mm as there is in the 15mm dominated DBX scene. This is important for those people whose main outlet for playing games is a convention tournament rather than the local club. Although the dynamics of this may change with the arrival of the two DBM successor sets, I doubt it will have much impact on the trend. I think Warmaster Ancients will remain the rules of choice for 6mm players right up to the point where Polymos Ancients are released. Next, Simon Hall asks, does campaign dress on a wargames table give a better feel than the brighter and more gaudy parade dress? Simon goes on to use the example of AWI British. I've hedged my bets here, providing both regulation and campaign dress. Do you prefer chocolate box soldiers, or units that look as if they've been on the march for a while? Now, this is always a tricky one for me, especially in Napoleonic armies. Life is too short for me to do every troop type in all options. Do you want your hussars with stung pelisses, even though they were either worn as a jacket or discarded one on campaign? Do you want French elite companies with shako plumes, even though they took these off when the serious action started? I still get asked for figures with pelisses and figures with plumes. Please let me have your opinions, as I always take these into account when sculpting new rangers. And finally, in the last cast, I pointed out that a poll had been initiated asking people to nominate their favourite Bacchus range. As only a small number of votes had been cast at the time, I said I'd update the result this time round. Unfortunately, only a few more have been added. The result is that ancient and early 18th century are now tied for first place. As this is still only on a small number of votes, I will wait till next time to give the final conclusion. So if you haven't already done so, please add your opinion to this total, and we'll all find out who's the king. The poll can be found in the general section on the Backers Forum. That's it for the questions. So send in any reactions to these and any more questions, please, any more questions to me at backers6@aol.com. And that's the end of the second Backers podcast. I hope that you've enjoyed listening and that you'll feel the desperate need to download the next edition. In the meantime, please send in any reactions to this cast and any contributions that you want to make for the next one. As ever, all contributions to backers6@aol.com. Happy painting and happy gaming. You have been listening to the delusional ramblings of Peter Berry.